He did have a good wife to do the whipping, after all. Colonel Bobovoy came back to the embassy on his way home from the airport. A short dispatch was waiting, which he quickly decrypted. He'd be working through Colonel Rozhdestvensky. No particular surprise there. Alexei Nikolaevich was Andropov's lapdog. And that was probably a good job, the resident thought. You just had to keep the boss happy, and Yuri Vladimirovich was probably not the demanding bastard that Bieria had been. Party people might be overly precise in their demands, but anyone who'd worked in the party secretariat doubtless knew how to work with people. The age of Stalin had indeed passed. So, it looked as though he had an assassination to arrange, Bobovoy thought. He wondered how Boris Strokov would react to it. Strokov was a professional, with little in the way of excess emotion, and less in the way of a professional conscience. To him, work was work. But the magnitude of this was higher than anything he would have encountered working for the Derzhavna Sugarnost. Would that frighten him, or excite him? It would be interesting to see. There was a coldness to his Bulgarian colleague that both alarmed and impressed the KGB officer. His particular skills could be useful things to have in one's pocket. And if the Politburo needed this annoying Pole killed, then he would just have to die. Too bad, but if what he believed was true, then they were just sending him off to heaven as a holy martyr, weren't they? Surely that was the secret ambition of every priest. Bobovoy's only concern was the political repercussions. Those would be epic, and so it was good that he was just a cutout in the operation. If it went bad, well, it wouldn't be his fault. That Strokov was the best man for the job, based on his curriculum vitae, was something no man could deny, something a board of inquiry, if any, could confirm. He'd warned the chairman that a shot, however closely taken, would not necessarily be fatal. He'd have to put that in a memo to make sure the thin paper trail on Operation 15-8-82-666 would have his formal evaluation in it. He'd draft it himself and send it by diplomatic bag to the center, and keep his own copy in his office safe, just to make sure his own backside was properly covered. But for now, he would have to wait for the authorization to come from the Politburo. Would those old women elect to go forward with this? That was the question, and one on which he would not make a wager. Brezhnev was in his dotage. Would that make him bloodthirsty or cautious? It was too hard a question for the colonel to puzzle out. They were saying that Yuri Vladimirovich was the heir apparent. If so, here was his chance to win his spurs. So, Mikhail Yevgenievich, will you support me tomorrow? Andropov asked over drinks in his flat. Alexandrov swirled the expensive brown vodka in his glass. Suslov will not attend tomorrow. They say his kidneys have failed, and he has no more than 2 weeks, the ideologue in waiting said, briefly dodging the issue. Will you support me for his chair? Need you ask, Misha? The chairman of the Committee for State Security responded. Of course I will support you. Very well. So, what are the chances for success in this operation you propose?
About 50-50, my people tell me.
We will use a Bulgarian officer to set it up, but for security reasons the assassin will have to be a Turk.
A black-ass Muslim? Alexandrov asked sharply.
Misha, whoever it is will almost certainly be apprehended. Dead, according to our plan. It is impossible to expect a clean getaway in such a mission. Thus we cannot use one of our own. The nature of the mission places constraints upon us. Ideally, we would use a trained sniper. From Spetsnaz, for example, from 300 meters, but that would mark the assassination as a killing done by a nation-state. No, this must appear to be the act of a single madman, as the Americans have them. You know, even with all the evidence the Americans had, some fools over there still blamed Kennedy on us or Castro. No. The evidence we leave must be a clear sign that we were not involved. That limits our operational methods. I think this is the best plan we can come up with. How closely have you studied it? Alexandrov asked, taking a swallow. It has been closely held. Operations like this must be. Security must be airtight, Mikhail Yevgenievich. The party man conceded the point. I suppose that is so, Yuri. But the risk of failure... Misha, in every aspect of life there is risk. The important thing is that the operation not be tied to us. That we can assure with certainty. If nothing else, a serious wound will at least lessen Carol's ardor for making trouble for us, will it not? It should. And half a chance of failure means half a chance of total success, Andropov reminded his guest. Then I will support you. Leonid Ilyich will go along as well. That will carry the day. How long after that to get things moving? A month or so. Perhaps 6 weeks. That quickly? Party matters rarely sped along that well. What is the point of taking such executive action? Isn't that what the Americans call it? If it is to take so long. If it is to be done, better that it should be done quickly, so as to forestall further political intrigue by this man. Who will replace him? Some Italian, I suppose. His selection was a major aberration. Perhaps his death will encourage the Romans to go back to their old habits, Andropov suggested. It generated a laugh from his guest. Yes, they are so predictable, these religious fanatics. So tomorrow, I will float the mission, and you will support me. Andropov wanted that one very clear. Yes, Yuri Vladimirovich, you will have my support, and you will support me for Suslov's full voting seat at the table. Tomorrow, comrade, Andropov promised.
Chapter 12. Handoff. This time the alarm clock worked and woke them both. Ed Foley rose and headed for the bathroom, quickly made way for his wife, then headed to Eddie's room to shake him loose while Mary Pat started breakfast. Their son immediately switched on the TV and got the morning exercise show that every city in the world seemed to have, starring, as everywhere in the world, a woman of impressive physique. She looked capable of waltzing through the Army's Ranger School at Fort Benning, Georgia. Because he had seen the Linda Carter series at home on cable, Eddie called her Worker Woman. Mary Pat was of the opinion that the Russian's blonde hair came out of a bottle, while Ed thought it hurt just to watch the things she did. With no decent paper or sports page to read, however, he had little choice in the matter, and Semi vegetated in front of the TV while his son giggled through the end of the Wake Up and Sweat program. It was done live, the chief of station saw. So whoever this broad was, she had to wake up at 4 a.m. And so this was probably her morning workout as well. Well, then, at least it was honest. Her husband must have been a Red Army paratrooper, and she could probably beat the shit out of him, Ed Foley thought, waiting for the morning news. That started at 6:30. The trick was to watch it and then try to figure out what was really happening in the world. Just like at home, the CIA officer thought with an early morning grumble. Well, he'd have the early bird at the embassy for that, sent by secure fax from Washington for the senior embassy staffers. For an American citizen, living in Moscow was like being on a desert island. At least they had a satellite dish at the embassy, so they could download CNN and other programming. It made them feel like real people. Almost. Breakfast was breakfast. Little Eddie liked Frosted Flakes. The milk was from Finland because his mother didn't trust the local grocery store, and the foreigners-only store was convenient to the compound. Ed and Mary Pat didn't talk much over breakfast, in deference to the bugs that littered their walls. They never talked at home about important matters, except via hand code, and never in front of their son, because little kids were incapable of keeping secrets of any kind. In any case, their KGB surveillance people were probably bored with the Foleys by now, which they'd both worked hard at, inserting just enough randomness in their behavior to make them look like Americans. But a considered amount. Not too much. They'd planned it out carefully and thoroughly at Langley, with the help of a tame KGB second chief directorate defector. Mary Pat had her husband's clothes all laid out on the bed, including the green tie to go with his brown suit. Like the president, Ed looked good in brown, his wife thought. Ed would wear a raincoat again, and he would keep it unbuttoned and loose around his body, should another message be passed, and his senses would be thoroughly sandpapered all day. "What are your plans for the day?" he asked Mary Pat in the living room.
"The usual. I might get together with Penny after lunch."
"Oh, well, say hello for me. Maybe we can get together for dinner later this week."
"Good idea," his wife said. "Maybe they can explain rugby to me."
"It's like football, honey. Just the rules are a little goofy," the station chief explained. "Well, we'll have to keep the reporters happy."
"Right," Mary Pat laughed, working her eyes at the walls. "That guy from the Boston Globe is such an ass."
Outside, the morning was pleasant enough. Just a hint of cool air to suggest the approach of autumn. Foley walked off toward the station, waving at the gate guard. The guy on morning duty actually smiled once in a while. He'd clearly been around foreigners too much, or had been trained to do so by KGB. His uniform was that of the Moscow militia, the city police, but Foley thought he looked a little too intelligent for that. Muscovites thought of their police as a rather low form of life, and such an agency would not attract the brightest of people. The couple blocks to the metro station passed quickly. Crossing the streets was reasonably safe here, far more so than in New York, because private cars were pretty rare. And it was a good thing. Russian drivers made the Italians look prudent and orderly. The guys driving the ubiquitous dump trucks must all have been former tank crewmen, judging by their road manners. He picked up his copy of Pravda at the kiosk and took the escalator down to the platform. A man of the strictest habits, he arrived at the station at exactly the same time every morning, then checked the clock hanging from the ceiling to make sure. The subway trains ran on an inhumanly precise schedule, and he walked aboard at exactly 7:43 a.m. He hadn't looked over his shoulder. It was too far into his residency in Moscow to rubberneck like a new tourist, and that, he figured, would make his KGB shadow think that his American subject was about as interesting as the kasha that Russians liked for breakfast, along with the dreadful local coffee. Quality control was something the Soviets reserved for their nuclear weapons and space program, though Foley had doubts about those, based on what he'd seen in this city, where only the metro seemed to work properly. Such a strange combination of casual klutz and German-like precision they were. You could tell how well things worked over here by what they were used for, and intelligence operations had the highest priority of all, lest the Soviets' enemies find out not what they had, but what they didn't have. Foley had Agent Cardinal to tell him and America what the Soviet Union had in the military realm. Generally, it was good stuff to learn, but that was mainly because the more you learned, the less you had to worry. No, it was political intelligence that counted most here, because
As backward as they were still big enough to cause trouble if you couldn't counter them early on. Langley was very worried about the Pope at the moment. He had evidently done something that might be embarrassing to the Russians, and Ivan didn't like being embarrassed in the political field any more than American politicians. Just that Ivan didn't go running off to the Washington Post to get even. Ritter and Moore were very concerned about what Ivan might do, and even more worried about what Yuri Andropov might do. Ed Foley didn't have a feel for that particular Russian. Like most in CIA, he knew the guy only by his face, name, and his evident liver problems. That information had leaked out through a means the station chief didn't know. Maybe the Brits. If you could trust the Brits, Ed cautioned himself. He had to trust them, but something kept making the hackles on his neck get nervous about them. Well, they probably had doubts about CIA. Such a crazy game this was. He scanned the front page. Nothing surprising, though the piece on the Warsaw Pact was a little interesting. They still worried about NATO. Maybe they really did worry about having the German army come east again. They were certainly paranoid enough. Paranoia had probably been invented in Russia. Maybe Freud discovered it on a trip here, he mused, lifting his eyes for a pair tracking him. No. None, he decided. Was it possible that the KGB wasn't tracking him? Well, possible, yes, but likely, no. If they had a guy, more likely a team, shadowing him, the coverage would be expert. But why put expert? But why put expert coverage on the press attaché? Foley sighed to himself. Was he too much of a worrier, or not paranoid enough? And how did you tell the difference? Or might he have exposed himself to a false flag operation by wearing a green tie? How the hell do you tell? If he was burned, then so was his wife, and that would put the brakes on two very promising CIA careers. He and Mary Pat were Bob Ritter's fair-haired pair, the varsity, the young all-pro team at Langley, and it was a reputation that had to be both protected carefully and also built upon. The President of the United States himself would read their take and maybe make decisions based on the information they brought in. Important decisions that could affect the policy of their country. The responsibility was not something to dwell on. It could drive you nuts, make you too cautious, so cautious that you never accomplished anything. No, the biggest problem in the intelligence business was in drawing the line between circumspection and effectiveness. If you leaned too far the one way, you never got anything useful done. If you went too far the other way, then you got yourself burned, and your agents. And over here, that meant virtual certain death for people for whose lives you were responsible. It was a dilemma fit to drive a man to drink. The metro stopped at his station, and he went out the door, then up the escalator. He was pretty sure that nobody had fished in his pocket. On the street level, he checked. Nothing. So whomever it was, either he only rode the afternoon train, or the chief of station had been made by the opposition. It would give him something to worry about all day. "This one's for you," Dobrik said, handing it over. "From Sofia." "Oh?" Zaitsev responded. "It's in the book, Your Eyes Only, Oleg Ivanich," the night duty officer said. "At least it's short." "Ah," Zaitsev said, taking the message and seeing the header. 15-8-82-666. So they figured that with a number instead of a name, the header didn't need to be encrypted. He didn't react or say anything further. It just wasn't done. Surely Kolia wondered about it. It was the office sport in communications, wondering about the things one couldn't read. This message had come in just 40 minutes after his departure. "Well, something to start my watch with.
Anything else, Nikolai Konstantinovich?
Nope. Aside from that, you have a clean desk.
Dobrik was an efficient worker, whatever faults he might have had. And now I am properly relieved of duty. At home, I have a fresh bottle of vodka.
You should eat first, Kolya, Zaitsev warned.
That's what my mother says, Oleg. Perhaps I'll have a sandwich with my breakfast, he joked.
Sleep well, Comrade Major. I relieve you, Zaitsev said as he took his seat.
10 minutes later, he had the brief dispatch decrypted. The Sofia resident acknowledged that Colonel Rozhdestvensky was his point of contact for Operation 15-8-82-666.
So, that T was properly crossed, and 15-8-82-666 was a full-fledged operation now. He tucked the decrypted message into a manila envelope, sealed it, and then dripped hot wax on the seal.
They're really going to do it, Oleg Ivanovich told himself with a frown. What do I do now?
Work his usual day, and then look for a green tie on the metro home. And pray he saw it, or pray he didn't.
Zaitsev shook the thought off and called for a messenger to hand-deliver the dispatch to the top floor. A moment later, a basket full of dispatches landed on his desk for processing.
Ouch, Ed Foley said aloud at his desk. The message, a lengthy one, came from Ritter and Moore, speaking for the president. He'd have to rattle some serious bushes for this.
Station Moscow didn't have a written list of agents, even by code names, and even in Foley's office safe, which in addition to a combination had a two-phase alarm built in, a keypad on the outside, and one on the inside with a different code, which Foley had set himself. The embassy's Marines had orders to respond to either alarm with drawn weapons, since the contents of this safe were about the most sensitive documents in the whole building. But Foley had the names of every Russian citizen who worked for the agency hard cut into his eyelids, along with their specialty areas. 12 such agents were currently operating. They'd just lost one the week before he'd arrived in Moscow. Burned. No one knew how, though Foley was concerned that the Russians might have a mole in Langley itself. It was heresy to think it, but as CIA tried to do it to KGB, so KGB tried to do it to CIA. And there was no referee on the playing field to let the players know what the score was. The lost agent, whose code name had been Souza, was a lieutenant colonel in the GRU and had helped identify some major leaks in the German Defense Ministry and other NATO sources, through which KGB had gotten political military intelligence of a high order. But that guy was dead. Still breathing, perhaps, but dead even so. Foley hoped they wouldn't load the guy alive into a furnace, as had been done with another GRU source back in the 1950s. Rather a cruel method of execution, even for the Russians under Khrushchev, and something that had kept his case officer awake for a very long time, the COS was sure. So they'd have to get 2, maybe 3 of their agents working on this one. They had a good guy in KGB and another in the Party Central Committee. Maybe one of them might have heard about a possible operation against the Pope. Damn, Foley thought. Are they that crazy? It required a considerable stretch of his imagination. An Irishman by ancestry and Roman Catholic by education and religious affiliation, Ed Foley had to make a mental effort to set aside his personal thoughts. Such a plot was beyond the pale, perhaps, but he was dealing with people who didn't recognize the concept of limits, certainly not from any outside agency. To them, God was politics, and a threat to their political world was like Lucifer himself challenging the order of heaven. Except that the simile only went so far. This was more like Michael the Archangel challenging the order of hell.
Mary Pat called it the belly of the beast. And this one was one nasty fucking beast.
"Daddy!" Sally exclaimed, waking up with her usual smile. He guided her to the bathroom and then downstairs, where her oatmeal was waiting. Sally still wore her bunny rabbit sleepers, with feet and a long zipper. This one was yellow, and it was the largest size, and her feet were stretching it. She'd have to change to some other sleepwear soon, but that was Kathy's department. The routine was set. Kathy fed little Jack, and halfway through, her husband set down his paper and headed upstairs to shave. By the time he was dressed, she was finished with her duty and went off to get cleaned up and dressed while Jack burped the little guy and got him into his socks to keep his feet warm, and also to give him something to pull off so that he could see if the feet tasted the same as they had the previous day, which was a newly acquired skill. Soon the doorbell rang, and it was Margaret Vanderbeek, soon followed by Ed Beaverton, which allowed the parents to escape off to work. At Victoria Station, Kathy kissed her husband goodbye and headed for the tube station for the ride to Moorfields, while Jack took a different train to Century House, and the day was about to start for real.
"Good morning, Sir John."
"Hey, Bert." Ryan paused. Bert Canderton had Army written all over him, and it was time to ask. "What regiment were you?"
"I was Regimental Sergeant Major of the Royal Green Jacket, sir."
"Infantry?"
"Correct, sir."
"I thought you guys wore redcoats," Ryan observed.
"Well, that's your fault. You Yanks, that is. In your Revolutionary War, my regiment took so many casualties from your riflemen that the colonel of the regiment decided a green tunic might be safer. It's been that way ever since."
"How did you end up here?"
"Oh, I'm waiting for an opening at the tower to be a yeoman warder, sir. Should have a new red coat in a month or so, they tell me."
Canderton's rent-a-cop blouse had some service ribbons on it, probably not for brushing and flossing his teeth, and a regimental sergeant major in the British Army was somebody, like a master gunnery sergeant in the Marine Corps.
"I've been there. Been to the club they have," said Ryan.
"Good bunch of troops."
"Indeed. I have a friend there, Mick Truelove. He was in the Queen's Regiment."
"Well, Sir Major, keep the bad guys out," Ryan said, as he worked his card into the electronic slot that controlled the entry gate.
"I will do that, sir," Canderton promised.
Harding was at his desk when Ryan came in. Jack hung his jacket on the tree.
"Come in early, Simon."
"Your Judge Moore sent a fax to Baz last night. Just after midnight, as a matter of fact.
Here." He handed it across. Ryan scanned it.
"The Pope, huh?"
"Your president is interested, and so is the PM, as it happens," Harding said, relighting his pipe. "Basil called us in early to go over what data we have."
"Okay, what do we have?"
"Not much," Harding admitted. "I can't talk to you about our sources."
"Simon, I'm not dumb. You have somebody in close, either a confidant of a Politburo member or someone in the party secretariat."
"He's not telling you anything?"
Ryan had seen some very interesting take in here, and it had to have come from somebody inside the big red tent.
"I can't confirm your suspicion," Harding cautioned. "But no, none of our sources have given us anything. Not even that the Warsaw letter has arrived in Moscow, that we know it must have."
"So, we don't know jack shit."
Simon nodded soberly.
"Correct."
"Amazing how often that happens."
"It's just a part of the job, Jack."
"And the PM has her panties in a wad."
Harding hadn't heard that Americanism before, and it caused him to blink twice.
"So it would seem."
"So what are we supposed to tell her?
She damn sure doesn't want to hear that we don't know."
"No, our political leaders do not like to hear that sort of thing."
"Neither do ours," Ryan admitted to himself.
"So how good is Basil at a song and dance number?"
"Quite good, actually.
In this case, he can say that
Your chaps do not have very much either.
Ask other NATO services?
Harding shook his head.
No.
It might leak out to the opposition. First, that we are interested, and second, that we don't know enough.
How good are our friends?
Depends. The French SDECE occasionally turns good information, but they do not like to share.
Neither do our Israeli friends.
The Germans are thoroughly compromised. That Marcus Wolf chap in East Germany is a bloody genius at this business. Perhaps the best in the world, and under Soviet control. The Italians have some talented people, but they too have problems with penetration. You know, the best service on the continent might well be the Vatican itself. But if Ivan is doing anything at the moment, he's covering it nicely. Ivan is quite good at that, you know.
So I've heard, Ryan agreed.
When does Basil have to go to Downing Street?
After lunch?
3 this afternoon, I understand.
And what will we be able to give him?
Not very much, I'm afraid.
Worse, Basil might want me with him.
Ryan grunted.
That ought to be fun.
Met her before?
No, but the PM has seen my analyses.
Baz says she wants to meet me.
He shuddered.
It'd be much better if I had something substantive to tell her.
Well, let's see if we can come up with a threat analysis, okay?
Jack sat down.
What exactly do we know?
Harding handed a sheaf of documents across. Ryan leaned back in his chair to pick through them.
You got the Warsaw letter from a Polish source, right?
Harding hesitated, but it was clear he had to answer this one.
That is correct.
So nothing from Moscow itself? Jack asked.
He shook his head.
No.
We know the letter was forwarded to Moscow, but that's all.
We're really in the dark, then.
You might want to have a beer before you go across the river.
Harding looked up from his notes.
Why, thank you, Jack. I really needed to hear that bit of encouragement.
They were silent for a moment.
I work better on a computer, Ryan said.
How hard is it to get one in here?
Not easy. They have to be tempest-checked to make sure someone outside the building cannot read the keystrokes electronically.
You can call administration about it.
But not today, Ryan didn't say aloud.
He'd learned that the bureaucracy at Century House was at least as bad as the one at Langley, and after a few years of working in the private sector, it could drive him to distraction.
Okay.
He'd try to come up with some ideas to save Simon from getting a new asshole installed in his guts. The Prime Minister was a lady, but in terms of demands, Father Tim at Georgetown had nothing on her.
Oleg Ivanich got back from lunch at the KGB cafeteria and faced facts.
Very soon he would have to decide what to say to his American and how to say it. If he was a regular embassy employee, he would have passed the first note along to the CIA chief in the embassy. There had to be one, he knew, an American resident whose job it was to spy on the Soviet Union, just as Russians spied on everyone in the world. The big question was whether they were spying on him. Could he have been doubled by the second chief directorate, whose reputation would frighten the devil in hell himself? Or could this ostensible American have been a Russian bearing a false flag? So, first of all, Oleg had to make damn sure he was dealing with the real thing.
How to do that?
Then it came to him.
Yes, he thought. That was something KGB could never bring off.
That would ensure that he was dealing with someone able to do what he needed done. No one could fake that. In celebration, Zaitsev lit up another cigarette and went back into the morning dispatches from the Washington Residentura. It was hard to like Tony Prince.
The New York Times correspondent in Moscow was well regarded by the Russians, and as far as Ed Foley was concerned, that spoke to a weakness in his character.
"So how do you like the new job, Ed?" Prince asked.
"Still settling in. Dealing with the Russian press is kind of interesting. They're predictable, but unpredictably so."
"How can people be unpredictably predictable?" the Times correspondent inquired, with a crooked smile.
"Well, Tony, you know what they're going to say, just not how they're going to ask it.
And half of them are spooks, or at least stringers anyway, in case you haven't noticed."
Prince affected a laugh. He felt himself to be the intellectual superior. Foley had failed as a general beat reporter in New York, whereas Prince had parlayed his political savvy to one of the top jobs in American journalism. He had some good contacts in the Soviet government, and he cultivated them assiduously, frequently sympathizing with them over the boorish, nickel-turny behavior of the current regime in Washington, which he occasionally tried to explain to his Russian friends, often pointing out that he hadn't voted for this damned actor, and neither had anyone in his New York office.
"Have you met the new guy, Alexandrov, yet?"
"No, but one of my contacts knows him. Says he's a reasonable sort. Talks like he's in favor of peaceful coexistence. More liberal than Suslov. I hear he's pretty sick."
"I've heard that too, but I'm not sure what's wrong with him. He's diabetic, didn't you hear? That's why the Baltimore docs came over to work on his eyes."
"Diabetic retinopathy," Prince explained, speaking the word slowly so that Foley could comprehend it.
"I'll have to ask the embassy doc what that means," Foley observed, making an obvious note on his pad.
"So this Alexandrov guy is more liberal, you think?"
Liberal was a word that meant good guy to Prince.
"Well, I haven't met him myself, but that's what my sources think. They also think that when Suslov departs from this life, Mikhail Yevgenievich will take his place."
"Really? I'll have to drop that on the ambassador."
"And the station chief?"
"You know who that is?"
"I don't," Foley said. An eye roll.
"Ron Fielding. Hell, everybody knows that."
"No, he isn't," Ed protested as sharply as his acting talent allowed. "He's the senior consular officer, not a spook."
Prince smiled, thinking, "You never could figure things out, could you?"
His Russian contacts had fingered Fielding to him, and he knew they wouldn't lie to him.
"Well, that's just a guess, of course," the reporter went on. "And if you thought it was me, you'd blurt it right out, wouldn't you?" Foley thought right back at him. "You officious ass."
"Well, I'm cleared for some things, as you know, but not that one."
"I know who does know," Prince offered.
"Yeah, but I'm not going to ask the ambassador, Tony. He'd rip my face off."
"He's just a political appointment, Ed. Nothing special.
This ought to be a posting for somebody who knows diplomacy.
But the president didn't ask me for advice."
"Thank God," the station chief commented inwardly. "Fielding sees him a lot, doesn't he?" Prince went on.
"The consular officer works directly with the ambassador, Tony. You know that."
"Yeah. Convenient, isn't it?
How much do you see him?"
"The boss, you mean?"
"Once a day, usually," Foley answered.
"And Fielding?"
"More. Maybe two or three times."
"There you have it," Prince concluded grandly. "You can always tell."
"You read too many James Bond books," Foley said dismissively. "Or maybe Matt Helm."
"Get real, Ed," Prince bristled with elegant gentleness.
"If Fielding is the head spook, who are his underlings?"
"Damned if I know."
"Well, those are always pretty covert," Prince admitted.
"No, on that I don't have a clue."
"Pity. That's one of the games you play in the embassy.
Who are the spooks?"
"Well, I can't help you."
"Yeah, it's not something I need to know anyway, I guess," Foley admitted.
You never were curious enough to be a good reporter, Prince thought, with a casual, pleasant smile.
So, does this keep you busy?
Eh, it's not a ball breaker.
Anyway, can we make a deal?
Sure, Prince replied.
What is it?
If you hear anything interesting, let us know here. You can read about it in the Times, usually on the front page above the fold, he added, to make sure Foley knew how important he was, along with his penetrating analysis.
Well, some things, you know, the ambassador likes to get a heads up.
He told me to ask, off the record like. That's an ethical issue, Ed.
If I tell Ernie that, he won't be real happy.
Well, you work for him, I don't.
You are an American citizen, right?
Don't wave the flag at me, okay? Prince responded wearily.
Okay, if I find out they're about to launch nuclear weapons, I'll let you know.
But it looks to me like we're more likely to do something that stupid than they are.
Tony, give me a break. This focus of evil in the world crap wasn't exactly Abe Lincoln talking, was it?
You saying the president was wrong? The chief of station asked, wondering just how far his opinion of this ass might sink.
I know about the gulag, okay, but that's a thing of the past. The Russians have mellowed since Stalin died, but the new administration hasn't figured that one out yet, have they?
Look, Tony, I'm just the worker bee here. The ambassador asked me to forward a simple request.
I take it your response is no?
You take it correctly.
Well, don't expect any Christmas cards from Ernie Fuller.
Ed, my duty is to the New York Times and my readers, period.
Okay, fine. I had to ask, Foley said defensively.
He hadn't expected anything better from the guy, but he'd suggested this to Ambassador Fuller himself to feel Prince out, and the ambassador had approved it.
I understand. Prince checked his watch. Hey, I have a meeting scheduled at the CPSU Central Committee building.
Anything I ought to know about?
Like I said, you can read it in the Times.
They fax you the early bird out of Washington, don't they?
Yeah, it eventually trickles down here.
Then, day after tomorrow, you can read it, Prince advised, standing to take his leave.
Tell Ernie.
I'll do that, Foley said, extending his hand. Then he decided he'd walk Prince to the elevator. On the way back, he'd hit the men's room to wash his hands. His next stop after that was the ambassador's office.
Hi, Ed. Meet with that Prince guy.
Foley nodded his head. Just to cut him loose.
Did he nibble at your hook?
Nope. Just spat it right back at me.
Fuller smiled crookedly. What did I tell you? There used to be some patriotic reporters back when I was your age, but they've mostly grown out of it over the last few years. I'm not surprised. When Tony was a kid in New York, he never liked the cops very much, but he was good at getting them to talk to him. Persuasive bastard when he wants to be.
Did he work on you?
No, sir. I'm not important enough for that.
What did you think of the Washington request about the Pope? Fuller asked, changing the subject.
I'm gonna have some people look into it, but I know, Ed. I don't want to know exactly what you're doing about it. If you find anything, will you be able to tell me about it?
Depends, sir, Foley answered, meaning probably not.
Fuller accepted that.
Okay. Anything else shaken?
Prince is on to something. Ought to be in the papers day after tomorrow. He's on his way to the Central Committee, or so he told me. He confirmed that Alexandrov will replace Mikhail Suslov when Red Mike checks out. If they're telling him, it must be official. I think we can believe that one.
Tony has good contacts with the political types, and it tracks with what our other friends tell us about Suslov.
I've never met the guy. What gives with him?
He's one of the last true believers. Alexandrov is another one. He thinks Marx is the one true God, and Lenin is his prophet, and their political and economic system really does work.
Really? Some people never learn.
Yep. You can take that to the bank, sir. There are a few left, but Leonid Ilyich isn't one of them, and neither is his heir apparent, Yuri Vladimirovich. But Alexandrov is Andropov's ally. There's a Politburo meeting later today.
When will we know what they discuss?
Couple of days, probably. But exactly how we find out, you do not need to know, sir, Foley didn't add.
He didn't have to.
Ernie Fuller knew the rules of the game. The U.S. ambassador to every country was thoroughly briefed on the embassy he was taking over. To get into Moscow involved voluntary brainwashing at Foggy Bottom and Langley. In reality, the American ambassador to Moscow was his country's chief intelligence officer in the Soviet Union. And Uncle Ernie was a pretty good one, Foley thought.
Okay. Keep me posted if you can.
Will do, sir, the chief of station promised.
Chapter 13. Collegiality.
Andropov arrived in the Kremlin at 12:45 for the 1 p.m. meeting. His driver pulled the handmaid's eel through the Spassky Gate's towering brick structure, past the security checkpoints, past the saluting soldiers of the ceremonial Tamansky Guards Division stationed outside Moscow, and used mainly for parades and pretty soldier duties. The soldier saluted smartly, but the gesture went unnoticed by the people inside the car. From there it was 150 meters to the destination, where another soldier wrenched open the door. Andropov noted this salute and nodded absently to let the senior sergeant know that he was seen, then made his way inside the yellow cream-colored building. Instead of taking the stone steps, Andropov turned right to go to the elevator for the ride to the second floor, followed by his aide, Colonel Rozhdestvensky, for whom this was the most interesting and about to be the most intimidating part of his official duties since joining KGB. There was yet more security on the upper floors. Uniformed Red Army officers with holstered sidearms in case of trouble. But there would be no trouble in his ascension to the general secretaryship, Andropov thought. This would be no palace coup. He'd be elected by his political peers in the usual way that the Soviet Union handled the transition of power. Awkwardly and badly, but predictably. The one with the most political capital would chair this council of peers, because they would trust him not to rule by force of will, but by collegial consensus. None of them wanted another Stalin, or even another Khrushchev, who might lead them on adventures. These men did not enjoy adventures. They'd all learned from history that gambling carried with it the possibility of losing, and none of them had come this far to risk losing anything at all. They were the chieftains in a nation of chess players, for whom victory was something determined by skillful maneuvers taken patiently and progressively over a period of hours, whose conclusion would seem as foreordained as the setting of the sun. That was one of the problems today, Andropov thought, taking his seat next to Defense Minister Ustinov. Both sat near the head of the table, in the seats reserved for members of the Defense Council, or Soviet Oborony, the five most senior officials in the entire Soviet government, including the Secretary for Ideology, Suslov. Ustinov looked up from his briefing papers.
Yuri, the minister said in greeting. Good day, Dmitri.
Andropov had already reached his accommodation with the Marshal of the Soviet Union. He'd never obstructed his requests for funding for the bloated and misdirected Soviet military, which was blundering around Afghanistan like a beached whale. It would probably win in the end, everyone thought. After all, the Red Army had never failed.
unless you remembered Lenin's first assault into Poland in 1919, which had ended in an ignominious rout. No, they preferred to remember defeating Hitler after the Germans had come to within sight of the Kremlin itself, stopping only when attacked by Russia's historically most reliable ally, General Winter. Andropov was not a devotee of the Soviet military, but it remained the security blanket for the rest of the Politburo, because the army made sure the country did what they told it to do. That was not because of love, but because the Red Army had guns in large numbers. So did the KGB and the Ministry of the Interior, in order to act as a check on the Red Army. No sense giving them ideas. Just to make sure, KGB also had the Third Chief Directorate, whose job it was to keep an eye on every single rifle company in the Red Army. In other countries, it was called checks and balances. Here, it was a balance of terror. Leonid Ilyich Brezhnev came in last of all, walking like the aged peasant he was, his skin dropping on his once manly face. He was approaching 80 years, a number he might meet but would not surpass by the look of him. That was both good news and bad. There was no telling what thoughts wiggled their way around the inside of his doting brain. He'd been a man of great personal power once, and Andropov could remember it plainly enough. He'd been a vigorous man who'd enjoyed walking in the forests to kill elk or even bear, the mighty hunter of wild animals. But not now. He hadn't shot anything in years, except perhaps people at second or third hand. But that didn't make Leonid Ilyich mellow with age. Far from it. The brown eyes were still sly, still looking for treachery, and sometimes finding it where there was none. Under Stalin, that was frequently a death sentence. But not now. Now you'd just be broken, stripped of power, and relegated to a provincial post where you'd die of boredom. "Good afternoon, comrades," the General Secretary said, as pleasantly as his grumbly voice allowed. At least there was no obvious bootlicking anymore. Every communist courtier jousting with each other to curry favor with the Marxist emperor. You could waste half the meeting with that twaddle, and Andropov had important things to discuss. Leonid Ilyich had been pre-briefed, and after sipping his post-lunch tea, the General Secretary turned his face to the KGB chairman. "Yuri Vladimirovich, you have something to discuss with us."
"Thank you, Comrade General Secretary."
"Comrades," he began, "something has come up which commands our attention." He waved to Colonel Rozhdestvensky, who quickly circulated around the table, handing out copies of the Warsaw letter. "What you see is a letter dispatched to Warsaw last week by the Pope of Rome." Each man had a photocopy of the original. Some of them spoke Polish, plus an exact translation into literary Russian, complete with footnotes. "I feel that this is a potential political threat to us."
"I have already seen this letter," Alexandrov said from his distant candidate seat. In deference to the seniority of the terminally ill Mikhail Suslov, the latter's seat at Brezhnev's left hand, and next to Andropov, was empty, though his place at the table had the same collection of papers as everyone else's. Maybe Suslov had read them on his deathbed, and he'd lash out one last time from his waiting niche in the Kremlin wall.
"This is outrageous," Marshal Ustinov said immediately. He was also well into his 70s. "Who does this priest think he is?"
"Well, he is Polish," Andropov reminded his colleagues, "and he feels he has a certain duty to provide his former countrymen with political protection."
"Protection from what?" the Minister of the Interior demanded. "The threat to Poland comes from their own counter-revolutionaries. And their own government lacks the balls to deal with them.
I told you last year we needed to move in on them, the first secretary of the Moscow party reminded the rest.
And if they resist our move?
The agricultural minister inquired from his seat at the far end of the table.
You may be certain of that, the foreign minister thought out loud. At least politically, they will resist. Dmitry Fedorovich.
Alexandrov directed his question at Marshal Ustinov, who sat there in his military uniform, complete with a square foot of ribbons and two Hero of the Soviet Union gold stars. He'd won them both for political courage, not on the battlefield, but he was one of the smartest people in the room, having earned his spurs as People's Commissar of Armaments in the Great Motherland War, and for helping shepherd the USSR into the space age. His opinion was predictable, but respected for its sagacity.
The question, comrades, is whether the Poles would resist with armed force. That would not be militarily threatening, but it would be a major political embarrassment, both here and abroad. That is, they could not stop the Red Army on the battlefield, but should they make the attempt, the political repercussions would be serious. That is why I supported our move last year to bring political pressure on Warsaw, which was successfully accomplished, you will recall.
At the age of 74, Dmitry Fedorovich had learned caution, at least on the level of international politics. The unspoken concern was the effect such resistance would have on the United States of America, which liked to stick its nose where it didn't belong. Well, this might well incite additional political unrest in Poland, or so my analysts tell me, Andropov told his colleagues, and the room got a little chilly.
How serious is this, Yuri Vladimirovich? How serious might it become?
It was Brezhnev speaking for the first time from beneath his bushy eyebrows. Poland continues to be unstable, due to counter-revolutionary elements within their society. Their labor sector in particular is restless. We have our sources within this Solidarity cabal, and they tell us that the pot continues to boil. The problem with the Pope is that if he does what he threatens and comes to Poland, the Polish people will have a rallying point, and if a sufficient number of them become involved, the country might well try to change its form of governance, the chairman of the KGB said delicately.
That is not acceptable, Leonid Ilyich observed in a quiet voice.
At this table, a loud voice was just a man venting his stress. A quiet one was far more dangerous.
If Poland falls, then Germany falls.
And then the entire Warsaw Pact, which would leave the Soviet Union without its buffer zone to the west. NATO was strong and would become more so as the new American defense buildup began to take effect. They'd already been briefed on that troublesome subject. Already the first new tanks were being given to line units, preparatory to shipping them to West Germany. And so were the new airplanes. Most frightening of all was the vastly increased training regimen for the American soldiers. It was as though they were actually preparing for a strike east. The fall of Poland and Germany would mean that a trip to Soviet territory would be shortened by more than 1,000 kilometers, and there was not a man at this table who did not remember the last time the Germans had entered the Soviet Union. Despite all the protestations that NATO was a defensive alliance whose entire purpose was to keep the Red Army from driving down the Champs-Élysées, to Moscow, NATO and all the other American alliances looked like an enormous noose designed to fit around their collective necks. They'd all considered that before at great length, and they really didn't need political instability to add to their problems. Communists, though not quite so fervent as Suslov and his ideological heir Alexandrov, feared above all the possible turning away of their people from the true faith, which was the source of their own very comfortable personal power. They'd all come to power at second hand to a popular peasant revolt that had overthrown the Romanov dynasty. Or so they all told themselves, despite what history really